Hello and welcome to the Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues of international affairs. My guest today is Linda Javan, a virtuosic writer, translator, interpreter, and subtitler. And we're going to discuss her new book, The Shortest History of China. Now, that is not the short history of China, it's the shortest history of China. And that's probably a good way to approach what is a mammoth topic. You know, we all have trouble summarizing last week's events, let alone 5,000 years worth of events. And at the start of the book, Linda writes, in writing a short history, a wise person might focus on a few key themes or personality. I am not so wise. So, Linda, on that point, tell us how you approach such a sort of gargantuan topic and distill it into a 260-page odd book.
Thank you so much. Okay, so it was something that when I thought about it, I got quite scared, you know, like how do you possibly put this giant history into such a small package? And I gathered lots and lots of materials around me. I had piles of books everywhere in my study. And I was dipping in and out and trying to figure things out. And at first, I actually thought I would organize it by themes. But then I realized that was even more confusing because you'd have to jump back and forward. And then I thought, well, there are certain things that you have to get through. You have to actually set out, for example, Chinese dynastic history has a certain order to it. You have to at least name all the dynasties. But I realized you don't have to name all the emperors. And I have always thought that most general histories of any place or subject really don't include enough women. So I was quite determined from the start that I would get as many women in there as possible, you know, 50% of the experience and far, far less of that in the recorded histories. So that was something I had in mind. And I love literature and art and film. And to me, it's not just important for my life, but it's so vital to the whole fabric of Chinese civilization and history, perhaps more so than in many other countries. It's just woven throughout. So, for example, Mao might write a poem, which I quote in the book, about heroes that refers to, it's actually an answer to an 11th century or Song Dynasty poem about a third century battle that has been popularized in a 14th century novel that's influenced popular culture ever since. So you have to kind of get these artistic and cultural threads to really understand a little bit more about Chinese history. In the end, I think it all came down to intuition. Things that I found interesting had to go in. And if it was inconsequential in the long run, or if there was one thing that was emblematic of many other such events, for example, one spectacularly corrupt eunuch in the Ming Dynasty, which produced a lot of spectacularly corrupt eunuchs, then I would just focus on the one, but make the point that they were emblematic. So it was a constant balancing act, and I was always, ultimately, it did come down to an intuitive approach.
Yes, I can imagine how intimidating it would have been. But I mean, I loved your use of poetry right throughout the book. As you say, there's artistic threads there. There's also historical threads. And it kind of reminded me, and I'm sure you had this experience as well, that living in China, for most Chinese, this is just part of what they know. In other words, they get the poetic reference. They understand when somebody refers to a corrupt eunuch in the Ming Dynasty in the 15th century or something. And they also understand instantly when somebody talks about an historical battle or something like that. So in some respects, I wonder whether in this book you were sort of, you know, in your own idiosyncratic informed way, but you're sort of mapping the sort of the Chinese historical mind, you know, what they have internalized. It's the sort of thing that we need to internalize as well if we are to sort of, you know, really grasp what's going on in China.
You know, I hadn't thought of it exactly like that, but I think you've nailed it because that's it is something that the Chinese historical mind comes into play in so many ways, and it actually determines how Chinese people, and from the ordinary people to the rulers, respond to certain events. And when you said that, it occurred to me there's another great example of why you need to understand these, the history and the culture and how it works together. And that is the Cultural Revolution. One of the things that, one of the first shots fired in the Cultural Revolution was Mao against, well, actually it was Yao Wenyuan, one of the Gang of Four, and then amplified by Mao. It was a critique of a play written by the vice mayor of Beijing about an upright official in the Han, in the Ming dynasty, who had been reproaching, he had tried to reproach an emperor who was not interested in being criticized and would have executed him but died first. And then he presented his ideas for good governance to another emperor. And he was famous for having been largely ignored, basically. And so by writing a play about this, that actually seemed to Mao to be an implicit criticism and to the level of threat. You know, this is how important culture is in China. And the Cultural Revolution began with this huge attack on a play about an upright Ming Dynasty official.
That's right. There, yeah, that's the High Ray Gets Dismissed, I think, was the play you talked about there. And that is fascinating, is you can write a play about a sort of Ming Dynasty official as the Australian equivalent of standing on the steps of Parliament and issuing a leadership challenge or something for the 6 o'clock news. But that's the way it sort of winds through the system. I mean, I want to ask you about, you know, the propaganda side of China, particularly under Xi Jinping, sort of posits a sort of continuum of history. You know, they build this sort of bulwark behind them. But one of the sort of themes running right through is not so much law, but that dreaded word, governance. Whenever I hear that word governance these days around town in Australia or in Sydney, I immediately switch off because it can mean sort of anything. But, you know, Xi Jinping's most famous book is The Governance of China.
Yes.
And if you look at a lot of what Chinese history, what you were writing about, a lot of it is about how you run things and how you do things, you know, with proper levels of hierarchy, divisions of labor and the like. I don't actually know whether you actually use the word governance, your great credit, but I thought that was a sort of thread running through the book as well.
Yes, and actually that goes back to Confucius, because one of the other very big threads going through the book are the philosophical, are the main philosophies that guide and have guided Chinese life for thousands of years. Confucius was born, I think, in 551 BCE, and he was born in a time when there were all these, China had broken up, or it wasn't quite China then, but it was the Zhou dynasty had broken up into all these warring fiefdoms, and it was chaotic and violent. And Confucius really felt that he had the right idea for how to govern, for governance, if you like, and also how people should live. So before you sit down on your mat, you should straighten it. Men's nightgowns should only come to the knee, all that kind of thing. He wasn't afraid to rule on any aspect of life, but he had a lot of ideas for how to govern. And one of his main ideas is that ritual is very important. The ruler obeys rites. But the reason for all this is to become and to demonstrate, to enact morality in action. So if the ruler is a good person, a philosopher prince who rules in a moral and ethical manner, then the country will naturally follow. So this was a very important concept, and it plays out today in Communist Party claim on legitimacy because it is the good ruler. It is, that's what it claims to be. So there's an element of Confucianism even today in the way the Communist Party rules. But as Jia Jianying has pointed out, she's a writer, a very interesting writer who lives in the United States now. If Confucianism is the outer shell of Chinese rule in traditional times all the way to the present, the dark heart is another kind of philosophy called legalism. And that also is very relevant to the present day. Legalism originated not long after Confucianism. It was around the same time. And the main philosopher was called Han Feizi, and he talked about how you can't rely on a ruler to be good. You can't rely on a ruler's innate sense of morality. So you need laws. Confucius thought laws were not a good way to run things because people would only think of how to get around them. But Han Feize had this idea that, no, you need laws. Don't worry about right and wrong. Right and wrong are whatever the ruler wants them to be. So if the whole point of laws is you shape people's behavior. You punish what you don't want them to do, and you reward what you do want them to do. And that's a more practical way of running things. And it's a kind of an amoral way, but that shouldn't be the concern. That's the legalist tradition. So what you see today, getting back to your thing about Xi Jinping and all of that, is we have this shell of Confucianism, of the essential morality and the moral legitimacy of the Communist Party, because they ended in the communist narrative, they ended the 100 years of humiliation and brought China up to the point where it is now as a great, prosperous, rising power. Never mind the human rights and all of that, because on the legalist side, you have to do what you have to do to prevent what you consider bad behavior, and you reward good behavior. Of course, the crystallization of that is in social credit schemes, but we see these philosophical themes being played out to the present.
Yes, it was interesting to read over time Confucianism. You had many critics over the centuries. You know, a lot of people just didn't like him as kind of snooty and moralizing. But the legalist critique of Confucianism, that it's basically useless as a governing doctrine because you have no incentives or ability to force people to do things. And so, as you say, it's only a kind of a shell. I thought that was quite a good way of putting it.
That was Jia Jianying, and I was quoting her. So she's, yeah.
That's right. What do you see as the areas of great continuum in Chinese history? You know, there's certainly dynastic cycles, which are often, there's scheming courtiers or corrupt or degenerate emperors. How do you, if somebody asks you, well, you've done the shortest book on China, it covers this enormous period. What are the areas, what is the thread that holds it all together?
Well, I think you've named two of them. There's a number of themes that actually hold it all together. And one of them is the theme of corruption, as there's been a sense since for at least 2,000 years that dynasties or governing bodies fall apart when they become corrupt, because at that point they can no longer listen to the people's needs. What happens is when they are too involved in self-enrichment, the people rise up, rebel, and overthrow them. So the fear of corruption taking over and destroying a once vigorous ruling system is a continuous thread. And it's very interesting to note that in 2012, when Xi Jinping came into power, the first thing he did was to launch a very, very big anti-corruption campaign. So that ties that whole thing together. Another tie, which you also suggested, is that of succession. So how do you manage succession? How do you keep it peaceful? In the book, I write about many, which, there was one where there were rumors of axe blows in the night, and we see instances of fratricide and of fathers killing sons and all this kind of terrible violence that goes on in the name of succession. So interestingly, that's still a problem today. So what happened when the communists took control, before, when they were in Yan'an, Mao, and I write this in the book, Mao meets a Chinese journalist who says, there's always been this problem of succession throughout Chinese history. What are you going to do about it? And Mao answers, democracy. Well, I suppose he has his own definition of that. But Mao ended up ruling for life, like an emperor. When he died, the next ruler to emerge, the next person to emerge as the kind of supreme leader was Deng Xiaoping, even though he only held one official main position. But Deng was very concerned, as was the collective leadership, to figure out a better way for succession into the future. So they created the two-term limit for top leaders of 5 years, two terms. Now, Xi Jinping, interestingly, abolished that two-term limit. So he has brought into play this whole historical anxiety about succession once more, and we really don't know what's going to happen with that. A third theme which is, I think, a very major theme, is that of unity. So throughout Chinese history, there's been a kind of a valorization of Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor, and the first emperor of Qin Shi Huang, who conquered, as they say, all China and united all China in 221 BCE. Now, I have a map in here that actually shows the all China that he united didn't include Xinjiang, Tibet, the northeast, the southwest, or even a big chunk of the southeast. Nonetheless, he united the various states that were in contention. He was also a tyrant. China has had many, many periods when it's been divided into warring or at the very best rival states. And they're seen as times of chaos and disunity and violence. So there's always been this ideal of unity. And what's happened in the present day is you have the issues of Xinjiang, Tibet, Taiwan, and Hong Kong as, you know, over the last, say, in the communist period, say, these have been all at play in a way. Xinjiang was only conquered for China in the 18th century. It had to be reconquered in the 19th century. It was never an easy conquest. And then after 1911, when the last dynasty ended and there was a Republican revolution, half of Xinjiang broke away and declared itself to be the East Turkestan Republic. So Xinjiang was then kind of reconquered in 1949 with the help of the Soviet Union and absorbed into the People's Republic of China. Tibet has its own complicated history, which I summarize in the book as well. Then you've got Taiwan, which became problematic after 1949 when the Kuomintang government, which the communists had defeated, went off to Taiwan. In the years since 1949, it's become a place that does not, overall, people do not identify in any way with China or support a reunification under the People's Republic of China. So that's an area that Xi Jinping is currently very focused on. And if people want to understand his actions towards Hong Kong, which is a different story, it was a colonial acquisition that was going to return to China anyway, but under certain circumstances, which have now been blown apart, an agreement which is blown apart. The people don't understand why Xi Jinping is suddenly so interested in Taiwan. Everyone wants to be Qin Shi Huang, the great unifier. Everyone who governs China wants to have this little bit of glory, to have unified China, whatever it means at their time, during their time. And now that's the focus on Taiwan. And we really need to understand that. We need to understand how deep that desire is and what it means for Xi Jinping as a ruler, both in terms of domestic challenges to his rule and to his own sense of who he is, in order to make policy that has some hope of, I don't know, it's a mess, but we do need to understand the historical background to be able to deal with it.
Yes, I was going to come to that issue, but you've covered it excellently already there. And of course, Taiwan, Tibet and Xinjiang, not to say all the sort of ethnic regions on the border with Korea, Russia, Vietnam, all have extremely distinct histories. And these days, that's not easy to discuss in China because, of course, all these places are inseparable parts of China. And it's very, you know, to take that on as a Chinese person in an historical sense is actually quite dangerous. I wanted to go back to one of the things you said about Xi Jinping and the sort of resonance of, you know, past dynasties rising and falling. To start with, as you said, he launched this absolutely remorseless anti-corruption campaign in 2012. The largest, certainly, since the foundation of the PRC. And that is his sense, you know, I think he had a sense the regime was being corroded from within, like previous dynasties. But at the same time, he ended this very successful nascent succession process, you know, making himself sort of leader or emperor in perpetuity. And in some respects, those two things, with an historical perspective, are quite conflicting, I would have thought. Well, what's your sense of that?
Yes, and that has been one of the essential contradictions in the Chinese ruling system for millennia. So you look at somebody like Hongwu, the first Ming emperor. And he was a peasant rebel. He'd led the revolution that overthrew the Yuan, the Mongol dynasty. And he was not, and he inherited a system where the bureaucracy, the administration, whatever you want to call it, is run by educated people, scholar literati, scholar officials. So he didn't trust scholars. He was uneducated himself. He didn't trust the scholars. He didn't trust the elite. And yet he realized he had to rely on them. So he had to figure out how to deal with these people who were running the show, practically speaking. And one of the things he did, very much like Xi Jinping, chairman of everything, who's made himself the chair of so many different committees, new and old, Hong Wu abolished this notion of a prime minister or a chancellor who would be the kind of the head minister to whom other ministers would come. And he made himself that person. So I see Xi Jinping an echo of that, that kind of, I want to control everything. I see this as really vitally important. He was also determined to root out corruption. But some of the things he did, which are not the exact same things Xi Jinping has done, but there are parallels, he made certain decisions to wipe out corruption that in the end had enough loopholes to allow it to flourish. So, for example, Xi Jinping declares he's going to wipe out corruption. He launches this fierce campaign to get what he calls both the tigers, the big ones, the high officials, and the flies, the lower officials. But what he doesn't do is he doesn't actually let it apply to everyone without fear or favor. So the people who are his closest allies don't get knocked down. And quite obviously, people who aren't his closest allies become targets. Now, that is a crucial flaw. You know, these are things that people do when they want to achieve something that's been very, very important, but they also are very self-protective and perhaps a little bit insecure or need to establish an absolute security, which of course doesn't exist.
Well, one of the reasons people say Xi Jinping won't step down is that he fears for not maybe his own life, but certainly the livelihood of his family and his supporters, because people will take revenge against them. It's the classic dilemma that's in a lot of Chinese history. I think they can't leave office because it's too dangerous.
Yes, I mean, that's absolutely true. And we see a number of cases, including with some of the spectacularly corrupt eunuchs of the Ming dynasty, where the second that their patron died, they were punished, stripped of all of their wealth. And you see in Chinese history, in many cases, it's quite interesting, collective punishment. So somebody might do something, and it's not only them that gets punished, but their whole family gets killed to X number of degrees. So there is that sense that the ruler has a network of people around him. It's always him who he wants to protect.
Yes, and some of the ways they die were not very nice. I think on a couple of occasions when people sort of lost their position or powers, I don't know whether I'm phrasing this correctly, they died by slicing or something. You know, slow slicing.
Yes.
Yes, mainly what we think about now when we're doing a sort of leg of lamb on a Sunday. Slow slicing in old dynastic sort of Chinese torture was literally slicing people until they bled to death, I guess. Is that right?
Yes, very slowly over a period of time. Sometimes it's translated as the death of a thousand cuts.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
But yeah, no, there were a number of punishments. And actually, this is quite interesting. So Qin Shi Huang, the tyrant who unified China in 221 BCE, he's said to have burned the books and buried the scholars. This is why he's also known as a tyrant. And this is why this is a central question. Can you unify China and hold it together without being a tyrant? But an historian said that he buried 460 scholars alive. Now, scholars have since said, we've looked at the Qin legal codes. They didn't have live burial as a punishment, but certainly he would have killed them. And I think one of the more interesting things about this is that Mao later boasted, Qin Shi Huang, people compared him to Qin Shi Huang, because as we said in the beginning, all of this history is alive. You know, it's constantly it's the Chinese historical mind. So when people said, you're like Qin Shi Huang, you're a tyrant like Qin Shi Huang, Mao said, Qin Shi Huang, yes, he burned books, I burned books. He buried 460 scholars. I've killed 46,000.
Yeah, that's right. His answer was what a wimp sort yeah. of thing.
The other night I was doing a bookshop event and a Chinese woman came along and she sat there rather sort of sour-faced the whole time. And she kept interrupting to sort of deliver the party line on things. And when I quoted that thing from Mao, she interrupted to say that he had to use violence because he overthrew the imperial order. And I was like, well, he didn't actually overthrow the imperial order, but, you know, okay. But I really wanted to say he killed those people not in the course of revolution, but after revolution.
And right through it. Now, I want to talk about, as you say, you've got a lot of important cameos for women. I think one of the women in the book, I hadn't realized this, is responsible, if I remember correctly, for systematizing the Gaokao exam or the bureaucratic entrance exam. But one of the amazing things about China these days, the communist China, if you like, you know, a load of incredibly successful women entrepreneurs, but right throughout since 1949, there's never been a single woman on the Politburo Standing Committee, in other words, the inner core of the leadership. So given your sort of historical, you've got the depth of looking at this over centuries now, talk me through that, because I've you know, every country has sexist traditions, Australia notwithstanding, but I find it amazing in China that political representation of women is almost zero.
Yes, it's a really interesting question. Right from the beginning, women who had any kind of control through marriage or you know, the empress dowagers and so on, the regents and so on, if they take too much power, it's said that it's as unnatural as a hen crowing at daybreak. So there was always this feeling that it was not women's place to rule. But when you get into the modern age and you have all these spectacularly interesting women and very, you know, talented women who are being able to express themselves, you begin to wonder what is it that's pushing against them so hard. And I have a feminist in there who fought in the 1911 revolution. Quite fiercely, and she wanted suffrage and she wanted equal rights, and she expected that. She was the first female member of Sun Yat-sen's Revolutionary Alliance. When the revolution came, he said, oh, not quite yet time. You know, the patriarchal impulse there is so strong and so embedded. Now, Mao did say that women hold up half the sky, but that didn't have anything to do with him wanting to bring more women into power as such. It was an observation made because in a village where things had just been collectivized, and as all over China, the men earned what were called work points. That was your salary. The men would earn more work points by far than women. And the women in this particular village just didn't bother going out to work. So the chief of women's work in the village suggested to the village chief, you know what, if we paid women equal to men, they'd probably come out and work. And so the village chief went, oh, that sounds like a interesting idea. And they instituted that. The women came out in this village to work and productivity tripled. It didn't double, it tripled. So when Mao heard that, because he was thinking productivity and all that, he said, women hold up half the sky and we should have equal pay. So there's always been this, but it doesn't mean we want women running things. Then Mao's fourth wife, Jiang Qing, had a very big role in the Cultural Revolution because she was much hated, because the things that went on in the Cultural Revolution were so violent and led to so much death and destruction and misery. Jiang Qing was a much reviled figure, and it was allowed after the Cultural Revolution to revile her. It's never allowed that you revile Mao for what he did. He was kind of protected. And so again, it was one of these things of the hen crowing, you know, women in power. They do terrible things. So yes, they can have their productivity. They can be entrepreneurs. They can be scientists. They can do all this stuff. But I think even though it's not explicit, it's not voiced, but I think it's a very, very strong impulse within Chinese power structures to keep women out. Hopefully not forever, but who knows?
Fascinating, the roots of the women hold up half the sky story. Look, it's been great to talk. I really commend the book, The Shortest History of China. I wish you the best, Linda. And thanks again for talking to Lowy today.
Thank you so much, Richard. I'm really, really happy to be speaking to the Lowy Institute today. It's been great.
Thank you. You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute, hosted by Institute experts. I'm Richard McGregor, with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhardt, who I'm really sad to say this is her last podcast and will be leaving us soon. Jen, we wish you all the best. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode of the Lowy Institute Conversations.